I don't know how many of you heard this past week about New York City exceeding the lead action level and advising folks to flush their taps before drinking. I don't know if, yeah. Today I'm going to be talking about EPA's lead and copper rule, which is the regulation that was followed and guided New York City through their testing and results. The title of our presentation is Flawed Science Begets Flawed Policy. And it's a presentation that focuses on DC as a case study, Washington, DC. I have no relationships to disclose. And I'm going to start by talking a little bit about why lead in drinking water is a health concern. Lead in drinking water was recognized as a health concern since the time of ancient Rome. And it was associated with brain harm, mental harm. Vitruvius, the Roman architect and engineer, wrote that water ought by no means to be conducted in lead pipes if we want to have it wholesome. But then fast forward to the 19th century in the United States, and for some reason we forgot all that wisdom and advice from the ancient times, and lead became actually a popular material because of its durability and malleability, and it became preferred to iron for lead pipes in distribution systems. Around 1900, over 80% of large US cities used lead service lines. And around that time, late 1800s, early 1900s, journal articles and reports from Great Britain and the United States started coming out and reporting links between lead in drinking water and lead poisoning. And by the 1920s, many US cities and states started reconsidering their plumbing codes and thinking about banning or limiting the use of lead service lines. And of course, as you would expect, the lead industry did react to that. This is an advertisement from 1923, the National Geographic. The lead industry comes out and says, lead is not only safe in your plumbing, it actually protects your health because it gives you best sanitation. Promotional campaigns by the lead industry continued until the 1970s, and the plumbing codes of large U.S. cities, including Denver, called for lead service lines well into the 20th century. It is believed today that there are approximately 3.3 to 6.4 million lead service lines, and that's such a wide, broad range because it's pretty hard to estimate. Some cities, like Chicago, were installing lead service lines up until the mid-1980s, which is when Congress banned the use of lead service lines. So what's a lead service line? Many of you might know already. It's the pipe that connects the water main that is under the street to a home. So starting in the 1960s, now there's all these lead service lines across the United States, and starting in the 1960s, there's a surge of scientific studies and epidemiological studies finding links between contaminated drinking water and lead poisoning. The most unambiguous and clear study showing such a link is a study that today would probably never get IRB approval. It's a study of infants, two groups of infants, one that drank whole cow milk from a carton with low lead levels, and another group that drank either cow milk or formula that came out of a can, and cans at the time were sealed with solder, lead solder, so solder contaminated the milk. So what the investigators found was that for the first group, there was a slight increase in blood lead levels, but not a significant increase. But for the second group, within 2 months of consumption, the infants had developed elevated blood lead levels, and they were controlling for confounding factors and really did find quite a clear association between the two. So after 1983, there were again more studies that came out linking lead in drinking water with health effects. And this series of studies and concerns was one of the factors that propelled EPA to develop the lead and copper rule. So what's the lead and copper rule? It's the regulation that EPA enacted in 1991 to protect the public from exposure to lead in drinking water. And already EPA at the time had made it very clear this was a public health protective law. EPA said that as little as 5% to more than 50% of children's total lead exposure at the time came from contaminated drinking water, and that for infants consuming reconstituted formula, over 85% of their lead could come from contaminated drinking water. So what the LCR does is that it requires water utilities to protect public health by doing two things. One is treating drinking water in a way that minimizes the water's ability to corrode lead pipes. And the other thing utilities are expected to do is monitor drinking water by capturing worst-case lead levels at the tap under normal water use conditions at high-risk homes. The lead and copper rule established two standards. One was a non-enforceable standard, a maximum contaminant level goal. This was the public health protective standard of zero parts per billion, that really drinking water should have no lead in it at all. But then it established an enforceable lead action level of 15 parts per billion because EPA argued at the time that for technological and other limitations, it just couldn't use the zero PPB as the standard. So what the lead action level means is the following, that water utilities, every public water utility, is required to go out periodically and look at a certain number of high-risk homes and test their tap water. If over 10% of the samples that they take come back with over 15 parts per billion lead, then the water utility is in exceedance of the lead action level. And this is what has happened in New York City. And then the water utility is required to take measures to protect public health. The tricky thing about the lead and copper rule, and what's interesting, is that it allows up to 10% of homes to dispense any amount of lead whatsoever. So if a utility finds 10% of homes dispensing any amount of lead, they don't have to do anything at all. The 15 parts per billion action level was adopted by the CDC as a health guidance, and the CDC today advises pregnant women and young children not to use unfiltered tap water when it has 15 or over parts per billion. EPA, up until 2004, labeled 40 ppb as a level of lead in water that posed imminent and substantial endangerment to children. And EPA considers 5,000 ppb of lead in drinking water to be hazardous waste. So what do utilities do when they exceed the lead action level? They have to go and treat the source water if it is contaminated with lead. They have to optimize corrosion control. They have to conduct public education. And they also have to begin replacing lead service lines when those exist in their distribution system. The lead service line requirement requires an annual replacement of 7% of a utility's total number of lead service lines, and it also requires utilities to replace the portion of the line that they own. Most utilities in this country own only part of the lead service line. There's some utilities that do not own any part of the lead service line, and there's only 1% of utilities that actually own the whole entire lead service line. So in essence, the lead and copper rule's lead service line requirement, even though it makes it clear that full lead service line replacement is preferable, essentially it's a partial lead service line replacement requirement. And here you see how it works. This is the lead service line. This is the part that the homeowner owns. This is the part that the utility is required to replace. EPA was aware of potential risks with partial pipe replacements from the beginning. Studies going back to the mid-1800s documented instances of high lead, accelerated lead release after connecting lead pipe with other metals. And before 1991, when EPA was asking for public comments, there were numerous commenters who had expressed concern about occasional increases in lead in water levels after partial pipe replacement. So why is that? There's three main reasons why you would have higher lead levels when you've replaced half the pipe. That is, first of all, because with a physical disturbance of the old lead pipe, just as the pipe gets cut, you can have lead shavings get into the water, or you can disturb the lead rust that's on the inside of the pipe, and all that can fall into the water. And then you have a phenomenon called galvanic corrosion. And what that is that when you connect old lead pipe with new copper, you can have the creation of a battery effect. So all of a sudden, you can have, in some water systems and in some cases, lead release starting to accelerate. You can also have a phenomenon called deposition corrosion. And that is, as the water is flowing from the copper pipe to the old lead pipe, you can have pieces of copper detaching and going down the pipe and attaching to the inside surface of the lead line. And at that point, they can create small little batteries right on the inside of the lead line, which can then start this corrosion process, the galvanic corrosion. So here you see, this is from a recent experiment at Virginia Tech. This is a lead service line. And this is the point where it was actually connected with new copper. And you see the scale, all that's here is the rust that is formed and starts to accelerate. And right next to it, you see particles, these white pieces up there, that have come straight from this specific pipe. And when they measured the particles, they found 50,000 parts per billion lead in drinking water. This dose exceeds the Consumer Product Safety Commission acute health threat for lead by 71 times. And obviously, it's way beyond hazardous waste levels. It's really not something we want to be drinking, and certainly not feeding our infants through their formula. EPA in 1991, when it wrote the lead and copper rule, did consider these concerns, and it looked at three specific studies that looked at the possibility of galvanic corrosion. And I'm not going to get into all of the details, but EPA concluded from looking at these studies that lead spikes after partial replacement, if they occurred at all, were probably going to be a very temporary phenomenon that consumers could be protected from with adequate education. EPA's interpretation of these studies is very highly problematic, and I can explain that later, but we don't believe that their conclusion was actually defensible based on what these studies and, of course, lots of others had to say at the time. So in 1991, what EPA said is that even though full lead service line replacements are absolutely preferable and the way to go, partial replacements do have benefits. Removal of any amount of lead is going to reduce risk, and any increases in lead in water will be temporary, and residents will be protected from adequate education from their water utilities. Commenters continued to express concern. Even after the lead and copper rule passed, commenters kept saying to EPA, you guys have no studies showing that when the spikes occur, at some point they do stop. There are no studies that are showing that. So we don't know for how long this spiking could be going on. And in fact, there's a pretty jarring internal EPA email that was sent in 1997 by EPA's expert on lead corrosion. And what he said in this email is, the bottom line is that EPA is promulgating a policy that knowingly increases lead levels for an unknown duration. The capital letters are his. So fast forward to 2004 in Washington, D.C. D.C. residents wake up to a front page Washington Post story that for 2.5 years, D.C. had had elevated levels of lead in drinking water. And in fact, in the summer 2003 monitoring cycle, over 4,000 of 6,000 plus homes tested high for lead. So over 60%, forget the 10% that we were talking about before, over 60% of those homes had high levels of lead. Some of those levels were in the hundreds and some in the thousands of parts per billion. And again, you look here, I mean, thousands of homes had lead levels that EPA at the time considered imminent and substantial endangerment to children, some hazardous waste levels. The contamination in Washington, D.C. Was prompted by a November 2000 change in water treatment disinfection from free chlorine to chloramine. So we switched from free chlorine to chloramine, and chloramine was eventually determined to be the main factor that caused this change in chemistry and all of the lead release. DC WASA, which is the DC water utility, knew about the contamination since 2001. It did not inform EPA until 2002. It began replacing lead service lines in 2003 and did only some replacements, 382 replacements that year, only 9 of which were full lead service line replacements, because even though it offered homeowners the opportunity to replace their lines, replacing the private side costs between $1,000 and $3,000 approximately, and residents were declining. In late 2003, research at Virginia Tech began showing that the chloramine in Washington, D.C.'s drinking water not only was had it caused that initial very high contamination, but it was also worsening this galvanic corrosion effect between lead and copper. So in February of 2004, Dr. Edwards of Virginia Tech wrote to EPA and said, such partial replacements should be stopped immediately. Of course, people at the time were very worried, very alarmed. A coalition was formed named Lead Emergency Action for the District, held a press conference, and demanded that lead service lines in DC are replaced fully rather than partially. A few weeks later, the Washington Post reported that after partial pipe replacement, testing in 2 homes in Washington, D.C. showed 24,000 parts per billion lead and 48,000 parts per billion lead in these 2 homes. And in fact, the Washington Post quoted experts saying that these residents should be able to taste the lead in their water, which is quite unbelievable. Obviously, this stirred tremendous public alarm, and the D.C. Department of Health stepped in and said to D.C. WASA, you need to stop cutting lead service lines, and you need to conduct additional testing to find out what's going on with these lead spikes and for how long they can last. Also, there were congressional hearings at the time, experts testifying that this was a very dangerous experiment that was going on in DC, and Congress said to EPA, you should research the effects of partial replacement of lead service lines, and if needed, modify the regulation to address the risk. So as a result of this pressure, here you have the Department of Health in DC and you have Congress, who are both pressuring DC WASA, pressuring EPA, and 2 studies come out, which are very, very critical and game-changing in lots of ways. The first study was funded by the water utility, DC WASA, but it involved EPA in the design throughout the process, and the idea was to look at 7 homes with partial pipe replacements, flush the taps for 15 minutes after replacing the pipe to try to get us rid of as much of the cuttings, the shavings, the particles at the time, and see what happens, what the results might be. So the top line here, this is their graph, is lead levels before replacement, and the bottom line, lead levels after replacement. There seems to be quite a significant drop. And the conclusion is that flushing for 15 minutes immediately after partial replacement reduces lead spike. So here the study says basically there's no problem with a physical disturbance of the pipe, because if you flush for 15 minutes, you're really okay. And also they didn't find any problem with galvanic corrosion. No problem, there's no significant increase of lead in drinking water. So even before the study was over, when they had preliminary, their first results, DC WASA went back to DC DOH, the Department of Health, and said, could we please continue now the program? You made us stop for a while, can we start again? So DC DOH said, yes, go ahead. So DC WASA started a very aggressive lead service line replacement program in DC. It signed an agreement with EPA Region 3 to partially replace all known lead service lines in the city by 2010. And this was the beginning of the largest lead service line replacement program in US history. In the meantime, just as the program had gone ahead, EPA and generally the official message and mantra about lead service line replacement was that partial replacements were actually a good thing. This is a quote from a NPR affiliate in Washington, D.C., the EPA Region 3 official in overseeing DC WASA is talking and basically says there was no immediate increase in lead levels at the tap, referring to the study from 2004. And over the long term, there's no evidence that the lead levels increase. In fact, if you remove half the lead, you have lots less lead in your tap water. Now, if you think about being a DC resident and being offered to replace your, the private side of your line, but you hear that replacing half of it is actually quite good, you might decide not to spend a few thousand dollars to do a full replacement. Now, what wasn't discussed and wasn't brought to the attention of anybody at the time was that this study in 2004, first of all, removed faucet aerators prior to sampling. And faucet aerators can trap particles, which can then start coming out. And it's really a method that even water utilities use sometimes to avoid finding problems. Also, what was not brought to people's attention was that the study found that average lead levels from water samples that were actually touching that connection between copper and lead still, after replacement, were above 15 parts per billion, so above the lead action level. And also, what was not brought to people's attention was that the highest post-partial replacement sample of 854 parts per billion was excluded from analysis because DC WASA and its contractors decided that there's no way that sample could have been caused by the partial replacement. What was later discovered, we discovered via Freedom of Information Act request, was that in fact every single water sample in this study, before and after partial replacement, was collected during a one-month period in Washington, D.C., where the disinfectant was switched back to free chlorine. So the chloramine that had caused the problem was out of the system, and the free chlorine was back in, and the free chlorine is a great corrosion control disinfectant. Every water sample was also collected with a very low flow rate, which again is a method to, you can miss lead problems if you just turn on the tap and have low flow rate. This is information that was just not revealed to anybody, and it was not written in the paper. So as the program is going on and you have this UJEC study that basically is treated by everybody, including our lawmakers and leaders, as the definitive study on partial pipe replacements, that they're safe and they're good, Environmental Science and Technology publishes an article that discusses the Virginia Tech research and says that lead leaching with lead and copper connections can increase 4 to 100 times faster than normal. In response to this article, and now of course everybody's watching and everybody's reading about these things, and certainly EPA and the DC Water Utility are very sensitive to the information that's coming out about this program. So EPA Region 3's consultants offer EPA to conduct a study to address these environmental science and technology article questions. EPA Region 3 agrees and says we're going to pay for it. So here's the study. It was released in 2006. The goal is to determine if replacing a portion of a lead pipe with copper might cause accelerated lead release. And the conclusion was that galvanic corrosion is minimal and in the long term likely inconsequential when you have old lead pipes in the system. like in Washington, D.C. So now this is the second study that basically says all is okay with partial pipe replacements. Really, not only legitimizing the partial pipe replacement program, but changing the public discourse around this issue completely and putting everybody's worries to sleep. The study, again, was considered as proof that partial replacements did not pose a risk. It was routinely photocopied and distributed to DC residents at every single meeting about lead in drinking water that the water utility held. It was used in 2008 by EPA in congressional testimony to allay congressional concerns about partial replacement. And today, it is still on EPA's website. What wasn't made clear about the study was that the conclusions were based on a measurement called surface potential, which is at very, very best an indirect indicator of galvanic erosion. The study did not include any lead in drinking water measurements, even though Freedom of Information Act requests have shown that there were some measurements. But these measurements have been lost, or nobody's willing to release them, so we don't know what they are. And water, very importantly in the study, was not allowed to stagnate in the pipes, which occurs in practice. You always want to have stagnating water to do these measurements, and it is known to worsen galvanic erosion problems. So these two studies are out there. Again, everybody is feeling comfortable with partial pipe replacement. But a 2007 Freedom of Information Act request revealed that by 2006, DC WASA and EPA had data showing very serious spikes and ongoing problems in numerous homes in Washington, DC after partial pipe replacement. So if you see here, There were very high levels in the thousands after 1 week and 1 month of partial pipe replacement, and also even from 1 month to over a year, the 90th percentile of lead measurements was still above the lead action level of 15 parts per billion. So this was clearly not a clear best solution to the problem. In 2007, we put in a Freedom of Information Act request to the DC Department of Environment and DC Department of Health, and we looked at 41 environmental risk assessments at the homes of DC children with elevated blood lead levels, and found that in five of those assessments, parents reported having had a partial pipe replacement. So in Washington, D.C., by the end of 2008, there were almost 15,000 partial pipe replacements that were done at a total cost of over $100 million. In 2008, in part because of data that the public obtained and was feeding the press and going to meetings and confronting public officials with, DC WASA's accelerated lead service line replacement program was terminated prematurely. Remember, it was going to go up to 2010. But it stopped. So what happened here is some very important data that came out of the CDC. In September of 2009, the CDC sent a letter to DC WASA saying, our results indicate, they had looked at data from Washington, DC, that the risk of elevated blood lead levels in homes with partial replacement of lead service lines is about four times that of the risk for blood lead elevations in homes without lead service lines. So this was, they were looking at children's blood lead levels and connecting them to homes with partials. In January 12 of 2010, CDC put up an announcement online for all childhood lead poisoning prevention programs saying that partial pipe replacements are associated with increased risk for elevated blood lead levels, and people should be careful. The CDC states that it shared its findings with EPA in 2007. In the US, partial pipe replacements have been conducted in at least 13 states plus DC. And this number does not include voluntary replacements that utilities will do when they do maintenance or road repairs or when they proactively want to get rid of lead in their distribution system. So there's a lot more partial replacements that have been done. So what's the science on partial replacements right now? Real world observations, a very good study actually by EPA researchers. They excavated actual lead service lines partially replaced that are 70 to 114 years old. And they found that the accumulating lead rust, that it was very visible, could contain thousands of parts per billion lead, which is not what you want to have at any point get into your water. Lab observations at Virginia Tech have found that increases in lead leaching after a partial replacement can be short-term or long-term, although there's really not much data that's unambiguous demonstrating the maximum duration of those spikes or the severity of the spikes or the causes, the conditions that create worst-case leaching. The spikes depend on the water's chemistry and on resident water use patterns. And they can occur whether the lead pipe is new or old. EPA, and that's a hopeful thing, is currently considering revisions to the lead and copper rule. Just a few days ago, they held a public stakeholder meeting in Philadelphia. And to our surprise, the agency's presentation of the lead service line replacement program made no mention of galvanic corrosion. Also, EPA did not discuss data or concerns about long-term lead in water problems after partial replacement. What was really interesting was in juxtaposition, all the stakeholders present in the room who spoke up, and that included water utilities, lead corrosion scientists, health professionals, and lead poisoning prevention advocates, called for a moratorium on partial pipe replacements. Questions we have right now is that many unknowns remain about the longer-term galvanic corrosion effects and about effective ways to protect consumers from excessively high lead in water in the short run and in the long run. Also, one of the questions is who gets to define what constitutes acceptable risk in this situation if partial replacements are continued to be allowed. And is it accurate and ethical to present partial replacements as an effective remedial action in every case? We know that in some cases, partial replacements do not result in spikes, but that's not the case every time. Thank you so much.
Couple questions right now, and then we'll save the rest for the end of the session. Yes?
I thought they stopped, the EPA stopped asking about the partial replacements because they had assumed that the efforts adding the zinc or the phosphate were successful in mitigating the lead levels.
You thought that EPA stopped asking? What do you mean by that? That they stopped
well,
asking?
Since the introduction of the zinc or the phosphate, the levels have increased. Now they say, well, there's different people studying that already.
Yes. So what happened is that in August of 2004, Washington, D.C. added a corrosion inhibitor, zinc orthophosphate, into D.C.'s drinking water to make the water less corrosive, basically. And the assumption by EPA has been that if you have better corrosion control, you're not going to have these lead spikes after partial replacement. And that has been the assumption all along. Even in the 1991 rule, EPA says, you know, we prefer full replacements, but partials are okay because when they occur, we're also going to make sure that corrosion control is good. And if corrosion control is good, then you're not going to have a big problem. Well, the data is showing, in fact, the 2006 data, this is after 2 years of corrosion control, that is showing very serious problems with lead in water after partial replacements. And also, there's evidence that, corrosion control doesn't always prevent this problem. Again, EPA has assumed that if you have corrosion control, you don't have to worry about partials, but the evidence is actually not showing that at all. Yeah.
Obviously, during the DC WASA situation, the agency and EPA had a consumer message that suggested everything was okay. That was the same report in the New York Times with regards to the Department of Health. What would be your message to the public health community about what we should consider
right.
these events when we're being told.
Right. It's such a good question, and I think that we really need to look at the lead and copper rule and all of the public education and even the education of water utility officials and health officials about lead in drinking water. The idea that there's this knee-jerk reaction to exceeding the lead action level and immediately trying to reassure the public that all is okay and that any levels of lead they have found do not pose a health risk is misleading, for one. It places people at risk. And at the end of the day, right now, given what the law is, how the lead and copper rule has been written, part of the responsibility for protecting the public lies with the homeowner, with users. So water utilities can do so much, and then users need to be told what the risks are. So it is, I believe that it is really critical for water utilities and departments of health to be forthcoming about the active precautions that residents need to take. And those can include filtering, flushing, using alternative sources of water. You know, there's various things people can do. And again, lead in drinking water is not, lead in drinking water is actually manageable. You know, people can protect themselves if they have the right information. And unfortunately, the lead and copper rule does not support delivery of the right information. And water utilities have not embraced programs that really allow people to protect themselves.